hulking and heavily tattooed Native American NCO in his doorway. The man's camouflage uniform was covered with badges and patches that were a testament to his career in special operations. The major stared at the combat infantryman's badge, master-rated parachutist badge, halo wings, and special operations diver badges that decorated the NCO's chest, tangible reminders of a life spent running toward the sound of gunfire. The major's own uniform was almost bare but for his rank, name badges, and single row of administrative ribbons. The Special Forces Group combat patch, ranger tab, and President's 100 tab on Odake's sleeve only added insult to the major's injury.
Sure, yeah, Sergeant Major, he said, glancing at his watch. Can you make it quick?
The walls of the office were covered with photographs and mementos from the major's single deployment to Afghanistan. There was a traditional Afghan pakol wool hat on the shelf, a decommissioned Chinese hand grenade on his desk, and a seemingly endless array of photos depicting the gerbil holding various weapons. Odake was amused by the fact that all the photos appeared to have been taken inside the walls of the sprawling forward operating base that the major likely never left.
Sir, I need you to take a look at this, Odake slid the request across the major's desk. Something's not right about it. I checked with some of the guys overseas, and they haven't heard anything about this program. We appear to be exporting weapons to an unknown entity.
Serko glanced at the form and frowned.
Where did this request come from?
That's why I came to see you, sir. It came from Colonel Fenson's office. Someone in D.C. asked him for a favor, from what I hear.
The deputy? You expect me to question a request that came down from an 06?
Sir, I don't really give a shit who it came from. I'm trying to prevent sniper weapons systems from being used against U.S. forces overseas.
Major Serko paused and chose his next words deliberately.
You think you're still a sniper, don't you? Better get used to the fact that you're not. You are just another staff NCO.
Odake's hands balled into fists as he suppressed the urge to pull the gerbil's spine out through his throat. He took a breath and pressed on in a professional but measured tone.
Sir, this isn't about me. This is about keeping weapons out of the hands of our enemies. This request is highly abnormal. No one that I've spoken to has ever heard of a combined U.S. sniper program with Turkey. At best, these rifles are going to be used by the Turks against the Peshmerga.
And what precisely do you expect me to do about it, Sergeant Major?
Sir, perhaps you could reach out to someone on Colonel Fenson's staff and dig a bit deeper. Once these weapons ship, there's no getting them back. Remember all of the weapons we sent to Afghanistan in the 80s?
Sergeant Major, have you ever heard the phrase, the nail that sticks up gets hammered down? The chain of command exists for precisely this reason. We must all do our part to keep the machine moving. These rifles need to ship as expeditiously as possible.
Serko signed each paper of the form and placed it in the outbox on his desk.
Anything else, Sergeant Major?
Negative, sir.
Odake turned to leave and then stopped.
Sir, you don't have to lead men in combat to show courage.
What are you talking about, Sergeant Major?
It's a pity you don't know,
Odake replied, leaving the office with no sign of his limp. Chapter 26. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa, March. Reese set his mind to developing a strategy to better address the poaching problem. He had his mission, now it was time to gather intel. Rich Hastings was delighted to have a seasoned combat leader dedicated to anti-poaching, and he offered him every resource available. Reese's first request was a wall-sized map of the area and all the reports of poaching activities they'd collected. Within minutes, Reese was staring at a pile of notes an inch thick.
Hastings' team had been diligent about compiling the raw data from the field, but hadn't had the resources to apply it tactically. Reese had seen the same thing happen in the early days of the counterinsurgency effort in Iraq. Teams would gather laptops, cell phones, and written materials from raids on high-value targets, only to see those intelligence gold mines go stale without procedures in place to exploit and analyze them effectively. Once they understood the benefits of sensitive site exploitation and coordinated with the intelligence analysts waiting back at base, their effectiveness in dismantling the enemy network increased exponentially. It was important that the PHs remain in the field, scouting and interdicting the poachers. So Rich and Reese remained in camp, compiling the reports and developing a plan. Reese was amazed that many of the targeting techniques employed by the Rhodesian SAS in the 1970s were the same ones developed by him and his contemporaries 3 decades later. Too bad they hadn't consulted with guys like Hastings back in 2003. Hastings' command of the local geography was essential in locating each poaching event, which was marked on the oversized map. As they pinned each poaching site on the map, patterns began to emerge. The poachers used 2 main travel corridors, the roads and rivers. The hunting blocks themselves were essentially devoid of human population, so the poachers had to come from somewhere. Movement on roads would be risky, especially during the day, but would be faster and safer than overland travel. After the poachers infiltrated the game-rich reserve and bordering hunting blocks, they would have the logistical problem of moving the meat, hides, or ivory back to their point of sale. It is roughly 15 times more efficient to move goods by water than by land under the best conditions, and the roads in this part of the world were less than ideal. Those same rivers that flowed rapidly during the wet season turned into sand pits in the dry winters. Reese's theory was that the poachers moved by water during the wet months and reverted to land travel only when the rivers ran dry.
"That's about right," Hastings agreed. "We've always suspected that the local fishermen were in on it. The bulk of the poaching takes place during the wet season. Part of that is the ability to use rivers, and the other reason is that we are not in the field as actively during the wet months because many of the roads are impassable. When we're out there scouting and hunting, we're a big deterrent. During the wet months, our PHs are usually back in Zim or South Africa visiting their families, which limits our presence. The poachers know this and work around it. Even if we could afford to run anti-poaching patrols all year, we couldn't get around without a helicopter."
"Too bad you don't have a UAV."
"What's a UAV?
"Unmanned aerial vehicle. A drone."
"Hell, we've got a bloody drone. None of us know how to fly the thing, but we've got it."
"What?"
"Some Russian client brought it with him last season, along with some old Soviet-era night vision that looks like it belongs in a museum. He wanted to use it to find game. We told him it was bloody unethical. He could hunt the way we do or find another outfitter. He got pissed and spent the rest of his trip drinking in camp and shacking up with his 20-year-old supermodel translator. He left the drone and night vision as a tip, kind of a joke, really. We were pissed because none of us had any use for it. We attempted to use the night vision scouting for cats, but the batteries ran out. So it's sitting in the shed with the drone."
"So you still have it?"
"Of course. It looked expensive, but we didn't have anyone to sell it to."
"Can we check it out?"
"Sure, come with me."
Hastings led Reese out of the dining area and toward what looked like a small thatched storage building. The building was dark inside, and it took a few moments for Reese's eyes to adjust after being in the bright sunlight. Rich Hastings pointed to the back corner of the structure. Reese couldn't help but smile at the sight of the dust-covered quadcopter-style video drone sitting on the concrete slab. It was an Inspire 2 drone, complete with a forward-looking infrared FLIR camera and an iPad mini-equipped remote control. The instruction manual was still in the plastic wrap. Reese brought it back to his makeshift headquarters in the dining area.
"Think you can fly this thing?" Rich asked.
"Maybe. Where's the night vision?"
"I'll get it."
According to the specs, the drone had a flight time of almost a half hour and could travel at 58 miles per hour. The maximum operating temperature was 102 degrees, which meant he couldn't fly it in the heat of the day here. That wasn't a problem, though, as Reese planned to use it at night. He began charging the batteries as he read over the instructions, hoping to give it a test flight once the air cooled down that evening. The misconception about drones was that you could have eyes in the sky everywhere at once. They had one drone, and its range and flight time were fairly limited, meaning that they would still have to develop a plan as to where best to deploy it. The drone was a game-changing asset, but not a magic wand. That evening, Reese was ready to give the drone its maiden flight. All the PHs were back from the field, and they gathered around, beers in hand, to watch Reese crash the expensive-looking flying machine. The camp staff weren't exactly sure what was about to happen, but they soon joined the crowd to see the spectacle. Reese feigned confidence as he carried the drone down to the fire pit area overlooking the river. The camp staff murmured in a collection of languages at the sight of the alien contraption. Reese activated the motor and the drone rocketed skyward. The joyful reaction of the native camp staff drowned out the whir of the four small rotors, and Reese couldn't suppress his grin. As the device held a hover, the iPad displayed a bird's-eye view of the camp and surrounding landscape. Carefully, Reese steered the drone over the river and eased up to its maximum speed. The flowing river and its banks were thick with animals at this hour, and the view from above was like something on a nature show as Reese steered the craft. He got the hang of flying it quickly and brought it around for a low pass over the camp. The staff cheered, and the PHs raised their beers in a salute to their new friend's flying skills. Reese toggled the display to activate the FLIR camera, and the scene was converted instantly to blacks and grays highlighted by the heat displays of the wildlife below. Elephants, giraffes, impala, and even crocodiles showed up in fiery reds and oranges. The craft stopped and hovered over a lioness stalking through the riverine grass in search of prey, invisible to the naked eye but clear as day on the screen. The camp staff were bewildered and amazed at what they saw, unsure whether this visitor in camp was a genius or some kind of magician. After 20 minutes of flying, Reese brought the drone in for a landing to the cheers of the staff and applause of the PHs, who were relieved that their new reconnaissance asset had not crashed. He smiled at the prospect of using it in operations against his new enemy. Chapter 27. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa, April. Reese had outlined a basic campaign plan and was feeling increasingly confident in his ability to operate the drone, but he lacked a ground force to physically interdict the poachers. His research indicated that the poachers were part of a larger syndicate, as vast and complex as the terrorist organizations he'd targeted in the military. Endemic corruption at all levels of government, low socioeconomic conditions, and high demand in Asia were fueling an illicit trade that generated more money than the illegal trafficking of small arms, gold, diamonds, or oil. There wasn't much Reese could do about the demand, but he could impact the supply. Reese was in Mozambique to keep a low profile, not to end up in what he assumed would be one of the worst prisons on Earth. That meant he couldn't lead the anti-poaching teams themselves, as doing so would require interaction with authorities, something that he intended to avoid. He ran the dilemma by Rich Hastings, and the two of them came up with a plan. Rich would use the resources of the Safari Company to beef up the capability and number of their game scouts, and Reese would act as their eyes and ears. Rich would assign experienced trackers to work with Reese, and once they got eyes on the poachers, they'd call in the game scouts. The government-provided game scouts were mostly good men with the right intentions, but they lacked any real training or experience when it came to weapons and tactics. Rich and his PHs, most of them ex-military and all of them highly competent in the field, could act as advisors to the game scouts when it came to larger operations. They would scale up their anti-poaching efforts during the off-season when the activity was at its peak, and scale it back during the hunting season when the PHs and game scouts had traditional duties to attend to, the ones that actually paid the bills. Reese would focus most of his time on coordinating the anti-poaching efforts while doing some general scouting for the safari operations as an apprentice or appy PH. Special Reconnaissance, SR, was a core SEAL mission during much of Reese's time in the teams. More recently, the SR role was spun off to specialized teams on each coast that performed highly technical surveillance operations in support of direct action elements like Reese's troop. Even though Reese hadn't done an SR-only mission since his first deployment to Afghanistan shortly after 9/11, it was something that he and his men had trained to do for years. In his war against the poachers, Reese would shift back to the SR role full-time. It would take some adjustment not to be the one leading the strike force onto the objective, but it was the smart play. Instead of being the quarterback on the field, Reese would become the offensive coordinator, calling the plays from the skybox. The fishermen steered the dugout canoe carefully to avoid the boulders at the river's bend. Without a moon, the stars still gave the older man enough illumination to navigate the waters he knew so well. The light, reflecting off the calm surface, made steering the boat as easy as navigating a modern highway. Not that he'd ever seen one. He used his hand-hewn steering pole to stop the craft, listening intently for any sign of movement on the nearby bank. All he could hear were the normal forest sounds, a steady hum of birds and insects, interrupted by the occasional bark of a baboon. Satisfied that he was alone, he poled the canoe toward the shoreline. "Okay, he's moving again," Reese said quietly into the Motorola handheld radio, staring intently at the IR image on the iPad, tethered to his drone's controls. "He's 10 meters out from the bank, 100 meters south of the scouts." He heard Hastings's radio break squelch twice, indicating that he'd understood. Reese was sitting on the tailgate of his Land Cruiser, on the opposite side of the river from the action, coordinating the events as they played out before him on the screen. "Land-based guys are moving toward the bank with the cargo. Let's wait until he gets out of the boat to intercept. He's 5 meters out. He's beached. He's out of the boat. Time to move." Reese could see the 6 game scouts move forward in a line formation, with Hastings at their center, keeping them moving in the right direction. When the scouts were 30 yards from the bank, the 2 land-based poachers dropped their cargo and fled to the east. "Coming your way, Louis," Reese advised. The PHs and their trackers were waiting in a blocking position, directly in line with the poachers' escape path. Louis waited until they were 10 yards out before he fired a round from his massive 500 nitro over their heads. The fireball and concussion from the express rifle left the poachers in shock as they dove to the ground at the feet of the blocking force. Louis and the other PHs quickly pounced on the men and secured their hands with thin rope as they searched them for weapons. The main force of game scouts tackled the fisherman as he tried to climb back into his beached canoe. The lead game scout placed the 3 men under arrest, carefully inventorying their contraband from the scene, with everything catalogued and photographed for use during prosecution. All told, the men seized a .375 H&H magazine rifle, along with 10 rounds of ammunition, a Chinese-made single-shot shotgun with 2 shells, 2 axes, 3 pungas, and a tireless bicycle loaded down with 150 pounds of elephant ivory from what looked to be 9 different elephants, all of whom were young bulls and cows. The 3 men were a sight to behold, barefoot and dressed in hand-me-down clothes from Western tourists